I'm coming this morning to a topic that has extreme importance, especially for two reasons. Number one, it addresses the most important question any government system has to address, and that is who has the ultimate power in the nation? Who has the highest power in a nation? That's a big question. But then it's important because there's another thing going on here in the United States. And if you were to ask me what is the, if I could just make one change in the whole United States in terms of the government, one change that I would make, what would it be? It has to do with changing what is going on with the Supreme Court. And I'm going to talk about that this morning. And so it seems to me it's a systemic wrong, it's a systemic disease that's come into our system of government that accounts for many, 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 many other problems that we have. And so the system of government that was established in the United States is no longer the system of government that we have in actual practice, in a very important way. Here having to do with the power of the courts. So it's a massive question, and I'm going to take two sessions on this, two class sessions on this, this week, and then next week a little detour because we have the privilege of having Dr. Peter Williams here from Tyndale House in Cambridge, England. And he was such a good teacher when he was here, such a good Bible teacher, and one of the world's leading experts on the authority of the Bible and so many other things. He'll be teaching next Sunday morning, and then on January 24th, 2 weeks, and I plan to be here with Peter, but I'm going to let him teach the class. And then on January 24th, finish up Chapter 5 on Part 2 of the Court. So if you keep that outline and bring it back. And then the schedule is begin to work through these chapters, Chapter 6, Protection of Life, Abortion, and Chapter 6, the Protection of Life, Euthanasia, on February 7th and 14th, and then we go on to other issues. So this is the outline, if you have it. If you need an outline, hold up your hand. If you don't have one of these outlines, there were out in your seats. Okay. The most basic issue regarding any system of government is who will have ultimate power in the nation. Different countries have given different answers to this throughout history. The most common answer has been a king, or in general, a monarchy. So that you have the royal family, and usually the eldest son of the family then becomes the prince and the king in the next generation. If the king dies, the queen is the monarch. There have been other examples of who will have the highest power in a nation. Many countries have just had dictators who have taken authority by force and power and imposed their rule on others. And in the world now, we have a lot of times a system where there's a prime minister, or a president, and then a Congress or a legislative body, a parliament, and they have the highest authority. Or another answer that really nobody ever likes is a system of anarchy where there's no ultimate power in a nation. And that's why we have piracy off the coast of Somalia today, because there's no effective government in Somalia. There's just anarchy ruling there. But the United States, when it was founded, gave a different answer to this question. The ultimate power in the nation would not be held by a king or a dictator or a legislature or a parliament or a prime minister or a president or any person. The ultimate power in the nation would rather be held by a document, and that is the Constitution. And so this was the attempt of the founders to establish a system of government that would protect the people from the abuse of power that came with kings and dictators. And for a long time, it did a pretty good job of it. And so I want to explain a little bit of that just for a few minutes. But it seems to me that that... Now, and when I say the Constitution has the highest power, ultimately, we have a form of democracy where the people have power over the Constitution because by a very difficult process, the people as a whole can amend the Constitution, but for ordinary functioning of the government, the Constitution has the highest power. Now, I think that this idea of a document having the highest power in a nation bears significant similarities to the government that God established for ancient Israel. Because there, the government officials in Israel couldn't just make up laws as they wanted. They were subject to a law outside of themselves, a written law. In fact, it was the law of God that now we have recorded here in the Bible. And so what did the king do? Well, Moses required that the king would write for himself in a book a copy of this law, Deuteronomy 17, 18, and that he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and all these statutes and doing them. So, and the classic example of the king being subject to the law was, as I mentioned earlier in this class, David, when he sinned with Bathsheba, committing adultery and then having Bathsheba's husband murdered, Nathan came to him and rebuked him and said, "You are the man, King David, who has committed this sin," showing that David as king wasn't the highest power in the nation, but there was God's law, and David was subject to the law. And so the government in the United States was set up so there would be a document, a constitution sort of overriding law that all the officials would be subject to, the president, the Congress, the courts, everybody subject to that government. And so it sort of looks like this on the diagram. It's the Constitution is the highest authority, and then the people and the laws of the nation, including the government officials, are subject to that Constitution. And I could draw an arrow back up around here and say, with difficulty, the people can amend the Constitution, but that's done very, very rarely. So it functions as the highest law. This was then under the Constitution, the Founding Fathers set up a system of government where there would be a whole lot of other ways in which we as a country would be protected from the tyranny of officials getting too much power and abusing that power and becoming essential dictators and getting all the benefits of the nation for themselves, as we still see in many countries of the world today. And the separation of powers was developed to restrict too much power from falling to one person or group. So one group made the laws, Congress, or states make laws, and local legislatures and boards, city councils and things like that, county boards. And another group, a different group, interprets and applies the laws and decides if the laws are consistent with the Constitution. And judges don't make the laws. Now, I'm going to back up here on the slide. See, there's a different system that we didn't establish, and that is the king or the president above the law, and then the king sort of changing the laws as it suited him whenever he felt like it. So I'm the king. John and Kathy come and make a deal to export bananas from my country. And we sign the deal. And then I see that John and Kathy are making a lot of money. So I just say, "No, sorry, I'm not going to take 10 cents per, you know, so many pounds of bananas. I'm going to take 15 cents. I'm going to change the rules." And you say, "Wait a minute, king, you're breaking the contract." And I say, "Hey, I am the law." So that's the system where the king is above the laws and he can make the laws to suit himself. And we didn't set up that kind of system. We set up a system, rather, that had separation of powers. So now this is the third diagram, and if you can kind of get a picture of this. We have the people elect the Congress, and the people elect state and local governments, and then the state and local governments make laws. The Congress makes laws, but all over on this side is the making of laws is one group. Then over on this other side, this is a separate group, the courts, and they judge the laws and whether the people have broken the laws, and they judge according to the Constitution and the laws. So up here, the basis for judgment of the courts is the Constitution. They look at the Constitution, they say, "Is this law according to the Constitution?" And they judge it. Or coming into a local court, they judge, have people broken these laws? And they judge that according to the Constitution and the laws. Incidentally, I announced that Mike had put in a candidacy for a judgeship, and did not get the interview. Sorry, but there's next time. Okay. So there's a difference, and there's a separation of powers, so that it's very important that the people who make the laws are not the people who judge the laws. If the same people could make the laws and judge the laws, that's like at the Olympics, if you're an ice skating competitor and you get to grade your own performance, you wouldn't probably grade it fairly. You'd give yourself extra special grades. Or if I let students in class turn in a term paper and I say, okay, now take it back, now grade it yourself. Well, they'd all give themselves A's probably. You have to have the judging process separate from the person or the thing being judged. And so this was a separation of powers. And judges do not make the laws. They interpret and apply the laws. And judges certainly were not set up to change the Constitution. In fact, as the Constitution was set up, judges had absolutely no role in making any new laws, nor did they have any role in the difficult process of amending the Constitution. I think this was a good plan, the way the United States was set up. And see, the goal is, we've got to protect the nation from any one person getting too much power or any small group getting too much power. And that was built on the philosophy or the idea that power corrupts people. And when they get too much power, their judgments are skewed and distorted. And so you try to separate the powers and distinguish the powers. So it's a good system, I think, because there's a separation of powers. The president has some powers, the Congress has some powers, the judges and the courts have some powers, and then the national government has some, but then some powers are left to the state governments, and some powers are left to the local city governments. So there are protections and separations of powers. I think that's a good advantage. Number two, that system had the advantage of accountability for those who make the laws. That is, the people who make laws over here, the Congress and the state and local governments, do you vote for these people? You vote for them? Yes, you vote to elect Congress, and you vote for the state legislatures and the city council. And these are the people that are most accountable to you because they have to come back and get reelected all the time. We see that going on right now, people gearing up for the elections in 2010, in the November of 2010. Do the judges make the laws? No. And they're not accountable to the people. They're generally appointed, and the system was set up so the people who make laws are the people who are most answerable to the people through the election process. Number three, the benefit is that there's a rule of law in a nation. The highest authority in the nation is not persons, but a document. There's a higher law above the Congress, above the state and local governments, above the judges, above the laws and the people. The higher law is the Constitution. And that is hard to amend. It requires 2/3 vote of both houses of Congress. You know how even with the Democrats' 60-vote majority in the Senate, the question, can they get 60 votes? Well, to get 2/3, you'd need 67. That's a big number to get in both houses to amend the Constitution. Then you have to have it ratified by the legislatures of 3/4 of the states. What's 3/4 of the states? 38, I guess, something like that. And so, or you can get a constitutional convention, but that has not happened. That has to be requested by the legislatures of 3/4 of the states, and then ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states. Requested by 2/3 and ratified by 3/4 of the states. Only 27 amendments have ever been made to the Constitution, and the first 10 were made right away in the Bill of Rights, only 17 since the Constitution was established. There's another benefit to this. There's a protection from fundamental change. Because it's so hard to change the Constitution, it keeps the country from becoming fundamentally different from what it was set up to be, and that's a benefit. And then five, it's protection from a hasty majority. That is, a big majority could get elected because of some national crisis or something and then put in a whole bunch of laws to change things from what they were fundamentally set up to be, and this is protection from it. Okay, so That was the whole setup. Did the system work? I want to come back to that. But now look at the Bible. Point B. According to the Bible, what should judges do? Was this kind of consistent with a biblical pattern? The essential role of judges, number one, is to judge according to a law external to themselves. This is really important that the judge can't just make up a law in his brain what he thinks it should be. He has to look at the Constitution and judge according to a law external to themselves. And in the Bible, that was true as well. Ezekiel 44:24, in a dispute, they shall take their stand to judge. They shall judge it according to my ordinances. And Paul, even when he's on trial in the Jewish ruling council, he says, are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet, contrary to the law, you order me to be struck. In other words, he's appealing to the acknowledged principle that the judge can't go contrary to the law. The law is over the judge. And then Ezra 7, here the king sends Ezra to appoint magistrates and judges who may judge all the people in the province beyond the river, and all such as know the laws of your God. Those who do not know them you shall teach. In other words, when you have judges, they have to know the law so that they can be subject to the standards of the law. And Ezra praised God for that decree of the king. All right, number two. Judges are not to show partiality or take bribes. Judges are not to show partiality or take bribes, because this would be using some other basis for judgment than the established laws. And so Deuteronomy 16, Moses commands, you shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes. They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality. What's partiality? That means if you're a judge and your friend comes into court, your son or daughter comes into court, you show favoritism. God says, no, don't do that. And you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall follow, that you may live and inherit the land the Lord your God is giving you. Justice means ruling according to God's laws. Example. Here's a law, Exodus 20:15. You shall not steal. And what about if you steal an ox or a sheep? Well, there's a specific law about that in Exodus 22:1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. So here's the principle. Scott here steals a sheep. I mean, Scott wouldn't do this, but he's in the front row. And when you're in the front row, you get to be an example. All right. Scott steals a sheep from Alan secretly at night. And Alan says, you stole my sheep. Let's go to see the judge. And so Ed is the judge over here. Okay, you listen to the witnesses. Ed says, Scott, you stole Alan's sheep. The law says you shall repay 4 sheep for a stolen sheep. And so Scott has to give Alan 4 sheep to repay the stolen sheep. That, the basis for judgment is the law. And the judge judges according to that law. That's what's supposed to happen. But let's say the night before it goes to trial, Scott goes and pays a visit to Ed and says, Ed, good to see you, Ed. Oh, there's 500 shekels in your hand. And Ed says, oh, good to see you, Scott. Well, I really can't take much more time tonight. Got to get to bed. Got a big case tomorrow. All right. And then all of a sudden they come into court and the judge has a new basis for judgment. He's got a new idea, internal to his own brain. No longer is the standard, you shall repay 4 sheep for a stolen sheep and you shall not steal. The standard is, you shall not steal unless you give the judge a bribe. And then Alan comes into court, and he thinks he's going to get these 4 sheep paid back. And Ed, the judge, and I know you guys wouldn't do this, but and Ed says, well, you know, this is a pretty doubtful case. I think Scott's innocent. And Alan says, wait a minute, he's innocent. No, sorry, I'm the judge, I rule. What happened was justice was denied. The guilty sheep stealer was allowed to go free because The judge started to use a different standard for judgment, a different basis. His new basis was in his own brain. You shall not steal unless you give the judge a bribe. See what happened? All of a sudden, justice is destroyed. And the rule of law is no longer functioning in that court. Now, there's some other verses that say that judges can't exercise partiality. So look under the chart here. Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his lawsuit. Exodus 23:3. So if Scott comes into court and says, I'm broke, I don't have any money, I need the sheep, that's why I took it. You can't be partial to him. You've got to rule justly according to the law. He broke the law. There were other solutions to his poverty than stealing from Alan. Or Exodus 23:6, it's just the opposite. You shall not pervert the justice due to the poor in his lawsuit. That means you don't give favoritism to the wealthy or powerful. So if Scott's just a rich man and he can get all sorts of friends to come and testify in his favor, he's still guilty. And you shall not pervert the justice due to Alan, the poor man. So you don't favor the rich, you don't favor the poor. And Exodus 23:8, you shall take no bribe. Leviticus 19:15, you shall do no injustice in court. You shall not be partial to the poor or defer to the great. So you can't favor the poor, can't favor the great. But in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. That's this idea of these statues where justice has a blind has something over her eyes, the statue representing justice, because justice is blind, that is, doesn't show favoritism to one person or another, but just rules according to understanding the facts of the case. I think that's what that statue means. You shall not be partial in judgment, Deuteronomy 1:16-17. 2 Chronicles 19, be careful what you do. You judge not for man, but for the Lord. Be careful what you do. There is no injustice with the Lord our God, or partiality, or taking bribes. So God is watching. In other words, watching the judge, and the judge has to judge fairly. Psalm 82, give justice to the weak and fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Proverbs 17:26, to impose a fine on a righteous man is not good, nor to strike the noble for their unrighteous, for their uprightness. So judges were to evaluate and judge cases fairly according to an established standard of law external to themselves. They were not to change the law or use any other basis for judgment than the law that was clearly established, a law that was external to themselves. Now, I could expand a little bit on the favoritism thing if you've got a friend. So let's say Carol has committed a crime, and she comes into court, but she just happens to be the judge's friend. And he says, well, I'm not going to rule against my good friend Carol. That's showing partial. Now the standard is, you shall not steal unless you're the friend of the judge. See, again, it's not the standard of law external to himself. He's got a different standard in his own mind that he's using. So all those things are distorting justice. Okay. What has actually happened in the United States? Point C. Judges were supposed to judge according to the Constitution and the laws that were established. And it worked pretty well for a long time. And in the federal, as opposed to the state or local, in the federal court system, we had district courts. There are over 100 of them, 100 and something. I don't know. 119, 120, 100, and I don't know, something. And then there are appeals courts. We've got 12 circuit courts of appeals in the United States. And then is the D.C. Circuit. No, I think that's one of the circuit courts of appeal. And then above that is the Supreme Court. So if you have a case that comes into federal court and you lose, you can appeal it to the appeals court. And we're under the Ninth Circuit here in Arizona, which is the appeals court in California and San Francisco, I believe. And then if you lose at the appeals court level, you can go to the Supreme Court. They're all supposed to judge according to the basis for judgment, the U.S. Constitution, if a law is challenged. and they're supposed to judge according to the Constitution. Now, what happened? There was a weakness in the system as it was set up. That was this. Gradually, over time, the justices on the Supreme Court of the United States discovered that if a case came up and the Constitution did not say something that the justices wanted it to say or thought it should say, they could claim to discover new principles in the Constitution, and no one would have the power to overrule them. Whenever they thought it was important, they could simply create a new law, but call it an interpretation, quote unquote, of some part of the Constitution. Suddenly, it would become the highest part of the land. Because they said it was part of the Constitution, then it was the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court discovered that it could become the most powerful rulers in the entire country. One example of this happened on January 22, 1973. The Supreme Court announced its decision regarding abortion in the case Roe v. Wade. This decision overturned the laws that restricted or prohibited abortion in all 50 states. And the decision gave women an unrestricted right to abortion, taking the life of their unborn child, up to the point of viability, that is when the unborn child could live outside the womb, and then it was about 28 weeks, but we just know of a baby that was just born at 24 weeks, I think, and has lived. But then it allowed for abortion to protect a woman's health after the point of viability, and then health became quickly defined to include mental health and well-being. And that opened the door to permit an unrestricted right to abortion throughout the entire 40 weeks of pregnancy. Because I don't feel mentally well, or to carry this baby to term, all right, you can have an abortion. The decision was a 7-2 majority. Nobody who ruled in that in 1973 is still on the court. Berger, Blackmun, Douglas, Brennan, Stewart, Marshall, and Powell were in the majority. Rehnquist and White dissented strongly. But now, wait a minute. How could the justices say, well, the U.S. Constitution guarantees a right to abortion? The word abortion isn't in the Constitution. How could they find a right there that nobody had seen before? Well, guess what? They found it in the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, passed in 1868, was to prohibit discrimination against those who had been slaves, as to prohibit discrimination on the basis of race. The 14th Amendment says all persons born or naturalized in the United... Now watch and see if you see a right to abortion here, all right? Carefully, you've got to be really smart to find it here. Okay. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So no lack of citizenship for being black or being a slave or anything like that or any other reason. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privilege or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Did you see how that would guarantee a right to abortion?
No.
Well, it was that amendment that the Supreme Court justices, 7 of them, said, these words guarantee that a woman has a right to abortion. Now, when this amendment was passed, remember, 2/3 vote of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of the state legislatures had to pass this. When it was passed, 36 laws in states or territories prohibited or restricted abortion. They all voted to pass this amendment with no thought at all that it was saying anything about their abortion laws. and the Congress. And so those abortion laws stayed on the books. In fact, the abortion law that was challenged in the Roe v. Wade decision had been passed in 1857, 11 years before that. And nobody said, oh, wait a minute, now you can't have those laws. Nobody mentioned it for 1868 to 1973, over 100 years. But the Supreme Court argued, and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor from here in Arizona wrote a key passage where she said the word liberty gives a woman the freedom to choose to have an abortion. Because this is an important liberty. Now, I differ with that because nobody at the time this was written thought that liberty meant liberty to break the established laws. Nobody thought it meant liberty to take the life of your unborn child. But the Supreme Court said, oh, now it does include that. And that's where they found the right to it. Justice Byron White dissented. He said, I find nothing in the language or history of the Constitution to support the court's judgment. The court simply fashions and announces a new constitutional right for pregnant mothers, and with scarcely any reason or authority for its action, invests that right with sufficient substance to override most existing state abortion statutes as an exercise of raw judicial power. The court perhaps has authority to do what it does today, but in my view, its judgment is an improvident and extravagant exercise of the power of judicial review. He said, I find no constitutional warrant for imposing such an order of priorities on the people and legislatures of the states. How should this issue be decided? White said, the issue, for the most part, should be left with the people and the political process the people have devised to govern their affairs. Justice William Rehnquist, who later became Chief Justice, also dissented strongly. He said, to reach its result, the court necessarily had to find within the 14th Amendment a right that was apparently completely unknown to the drafters of that amendment. By the time of the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868, there were at least 36 laws enacted by state or territorial legislatures limiting abortion. There apparently was no question concerning the validity of this Texas law, nor of any other state statutes when the 14th Amendment was adopted. The only conclusion possible from this history is that the drafters did not intend that the 14th Amendment withdraw from the states the power to legislate with regard to this matter. But the two in the minority lost. And so Roe v. Wade became the law of the land, and it has remained so to that day, to this day. So 1973 to 2010, what is that, 37 years now. And there was nothing that anybody in the nation could do about it, because there's no appeal above the Supreme Court. And you could, in theory, pass laws in the legislatures of all 50 states saying we prohibit abortion in these circumstances or these, and some states have tried to do that, and it would have no effect because the Supreme Court said that can't happen. It's contrary to the Constitution, as they now tell us the Constitution means. And you could have 100% you could have a 100% vote of the House and Senate saying we're going to put these restrictions on abortions, and it would do nothing. Would have no effect. So do you see that the people and the president is powerless, the Congress is powerless, the states are powerless? Nobody can do anything once the Supreme Court has made this decision. But did they decide according to the Constitution? No, they didn't. That wasn't what the 14th Amendment meant. Here's what they've done. They've done the equivalent of you shall not steal a sheep unless you give the judge a bribe. Or you shall not steal a sheep unless you're the friend of the judge. They are now judging not according to the Constitution, the old basis for judgment. The new basis for judgment is the U.S. Constitution plus the nine justices' ideas of what is good. And their ideas of what is good was we should have a right to abortion. And so the system is broken. As the Supreme Court issued more and more decisions of this nature, decisions that were not grounded in any law that had been passed by any Congress or state legislature and were not part of what the Constitution originally meant, the Supreme Court became, in actual functioning, the highest governing authority in the nation. They discovered that they had the freedom to make up new constitutional doctrines whenever they could get a majority of 5 persons to do so. And they could just claim, oh, we discovered some new meaning in this vague principle of the Constitution, one principle or another. It's happened so often in the last several decades that many people in the United States simply assume that this is what will happen. It's like kids today grow up thinking that everybody always had computers. When you grow up and it's just happening, you think, oh, that's the way life is. And so we think, oh, this is how the Supreme Court's supposed to function. This is how our country is supposed to work. But it's far different from the government that was originally established. And note what is happening now. If I go back to that earlier system, where the people who make the laws are not the people who judge the laws, completely separate, where the judges had no role in making new laws, no role in changing the Constitution, now the process of making the most important laws in our nation, the biggest disputes, that process is over here, and the same people who make the laws are the people who judge the laws. That's just like students grading their own tests. Or an ice skating competitor grading his or her own ice skating performance. You don't have the separation of powers between making laws and evaluating or judging laws anymore. And no person, and no group, and no government agency has any authority over the Supreme Court. It can simply invent new provisions that it claims are part of the Constitution now. And no one but the court itself can call into question or overrule or change its decisions. And since Supreme Court justices are appointed for life, they are accountable to no one. New justices can be appointed by the president with the consent of the Senate, but they can stay on for 30 years or more. And no one can overrule them as long as they're in office. And now the most important laws of the land that decide the most fundamental issues facing our society are not made by the government officials who are closest to the people and accountable to the people, the Congress and the state and local governments, but they're made by a group of justices who have never been elected by the people and have no accountability whatever to the people of the nation. Did you vote for any Supreme Court justice? No, you didn't. There's no accountability because they're appointed, not elected. Thus, the system is completely opposite from the wise system devised by the founding fathers in the United States. As the Constitution was written, the judges were to have absolutely no role in making laws or amending the Constitution. They were to judge according to standard of laws outside of themselves, a standard over which they would have no influence at all. But now the system is reversed, so they have the only influence that can ultimately prevail. Now, was it only on abortion that this happened? No. It's affected hundreds of other issues. And I want to go on and talk about those in the next section of the outline, but I am going to stop here. Is this making sense now? And do you see why I say this is broken? This is the most important or the most harmful wrong that has come to the nation to my mind. It's the idea of judges that they can make up new laws and call them interpretations of the Constitution, and nobody can do anything about it. So if I could change one thing in the country, it would be this. Now, there is a way to change it, but you're going to have to come back 2 weeks from today to hear me find out about it. Now, look, I want to... Ben Bull is here. Ben's the senior legal counsel for Alliance Defense Fund. Is that the... Something like that. I don't know. But I asked Ben if he'd come to help if I got in trouble, but also, do you want to make some comments on this, Ben, or correct me if...
Well, this is a surprise.
Well, I'm sorry. Just bring it on.
I think you nailed it. I think that the greatest threat to our freedom, it comes from the black robes, as we joke. Everything from Guantanamo and the creation of constitutional rights for foreign combatants, where the Supreme Court, out of thin air, decided that the Geneva Conventions apply to members of Al-Qaeda, even though, by its very terms, Geneva, the convention only applies to countries which have reciprocity, where both countries have adopted the convention, to coming up with this constitutional right to privacy, which gives homosexual sodomy constitutional protection. That was completely out of thin air. There was no tradition or no support for that, except for the five judges that have that decided that that was a cool thing to do, something that it was, you know, the time was right according to their view. And that's why the appointment of judges has become so politicized.
Yeah.
Where you destroy people not on the basis of their credentials for being judges, but based upon trumped up things. You know, they're borked, as they say. But I think you've got it. And just a real frightening thing that all believers need to be aware of and know that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, virtually everything that the founders put in there came from the Bible, came from Scripture.
Principles.
So to the extent we drift away from that, we move away from Scripture. And that's what's happened now, this out of balance, out of whack kind of condition.
Is there any way to change it?
Any way to change it? Well, about the only way right now is to elect godly people to Congress. Amending the Constitution. You know, it actually happened fairly frequently for about 150 years. And then the left got into power, and they don't want to amend the Constitution anymore. It's curious how that works.
What about new justices being appointed to the Supreme Court who will rule according to the original meaning of the Supreme Court?
Well, that would do it. I mean, clearly, there are four justices at the Supreme Court right now that are what are called originalists. Robert Alito,
Scalia.
Thomas and Scalia, yeah, those four. And basically, you know, their philosophy is what you've described as the correct one. You go back to the original intention of the Constitution, and you apply it to the events of today. But there are five out of nine, sort of Kennedy's on the fence, but at least four out of nine solid justices that believe that the Constitution is a living, breathing document that means what you mean it to mean at any given point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Words are like plastic. It can be rearranged and do whatever four of the nine want to do. Yeah. Kennedy kind of goes one way or the other, depending on...
On the issue.
On the issue, I guess, yeah.
That's and right. His idea of what, which way it should go, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we have four out of nine right now. And this isn't about being a conservative or a liberal or a Democrat or Republican or libertarian, whatever. It's about being committed to what the founders put in the Constitution.
Yeah.
Because it cuts the way it cuts.
It's about rule of law.
It's about rule of law.
Now, yeah. Ben, I've heard, and I'm not a lawyer, but I've heard that in other kinds of legal issues, there's a principle that the meaning of the words of a law, the meaning is what the words meant at the time the law was adopted. Is that correct? And then that, if that were applied to the Constitution, you wouldn't have any of this.
That's exactly right. Now, the words were written in the late 18th century, but... Still, there were contemporaneous documents, the Federalist Papers,
right,
which explained what those words meant.
Yeah.
And, again, four out of nine justices basically are ignoring that and going according to their own subjective whim at the moment. Yep.
And, maybe the greatest harm isn't what's already been done, but it's what could be done by this process. It's totally out of our control. Can Congress impeach the Supreme Court?
They can impeach them. It's
unlikely.
Yeah, unlikely.
Possible, but unlikely.
It's you can impeach them, then you have a trial in the House of Representatives. Yeah. A justice has to commit high crimes and misdemeanors, and It's never happened.
And this would be called theories of interpretation, and it wouldn't be called sufficient grounds for dismissal.
Exactly. And you know, the media would be against it, so that, yeah. So the politicians would run for cover, and they'd never do it. So.
About 10 years ago, I was teaching out in Washington, D.C. suburbs in Maryland, and had opportunity through a connection my son had made to meet with a congressman, Charles Kennedy, who was from Florida and was an evangelical believer, and had dinner with him and his wife. And he was in the House of Representatives, and he was chairman of the subcommittee on the Constitution in the Judiciary Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. So I had one and only one thing to talk about at that dinner, and that is, Charles, this system is broken, or Congressman Kennedy. We've gotten to know him, and I call him Charles now. But this system is broken. Can't you do something about it? Because if any change is going to come, it'd come out of the House Judiciary Committee, and it'd come out of the subcommittee on the Constitution, and you are the chairman of that. And so I had all these different ideas, and he said, well, we tried that, didn't work, tried that, didn't work, tried that, didn't work. And he thought the only way to change it was, and he agreed with me about the thing being wrong. He said he thinks the only way to change it is getting new justices appointed to the Supreme Court. So, and I hope he gets there one day. He's now on the Supreme Court of Florida, of the state of Florida. So, and, well, okay. Well, now, comments or interaction on this? Yep. Well, what's your name here? Just a second. There's a microphone coming. JT.
They're appointed for a lifetime career of being a Supreme Court justice. Who established that?
The Constitution.
The Constitution did that.
Yep.
Well, there's one flaw.
Well, they did it to protect them from to give them independence, see, and to protect them from having to go back and be elected by vote and things like that, because they weren't supposed to change laws. They were just supposed to be good at deciding whether it's according to a law or not. What's your name?
Bill Anthony. I heard just the other day, and I don't remember where I heard it, but that Thomas Jefferson had actually, in effect, fired half of the, not the Supreme Court, but the by not paying them.
Oh, the other judges, the lower courts?
The lower courts.
Oh, I don't know.
And the idea was, if you want to get rid of the Ninth Circuit, you just say, I'm not going to pay you anymore, and they all go away, and then you reelect people somehow.
Yeah.
But I heard Thomas Jefferson got rid of half of those judges.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we can still do that or not.
Yeah. Well, interesting idea, but I know what would happen. They'd say, we'll serve for free, and George Soros is going to pay us. Bob Sampieri over here, just microphone coming.
What's the pros and cons on packing the court like Roosevelt did, instead of just 9 justices?
Yeah, 15.
When the climate is right.
Yeah, he tried to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, again, that would take, I believe, a constitutional amendment. I don't know. Do you know, Ben? Or Steve, do you know? I think, Bob, I don't know if it, I doubt that it could be done, but if it could be done, Roosevelt tried, FDR tried to appoint 6 more justices so they would rule according to how he wanted them to rule, but the country rebelled against it. And see, that would be seen as tampering with the system, I think. So, yeah. Ben?
You know, what a lot of people don't realize is that the founders intended the Supreme Court to be really a very weak institution. That early on, Washington and Adams and their first presidents had difficulty finding people who even wanted to be on the Supreme Court because the federal government was intended to be very, very weak.
Yeah.
That they only had specific powers and all other powers resided with the states. So nobody wanted to be on the Supreme Court.
Oh, wish
things have changed.
Yes, I guess. Okay. What else? Anybody else? Yes, God. Just hold on a second.
I was just thinking, first of all, what evidence is there that it really has changed since the beginning, number one? And number two, the fact that people live so much longer now today, I mean, it has an effect, you know, like if you have, let's say, you know, the Chief Justice now, Roberts, I mean, he can kind of bide his time more, Like, he's not going to retire probably while President Obama is president. He's going to wait until a Republican. So what effect do those things have, and has it really changed?
Well, I mean, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams died in their 90s, I believe. So healthy people live still fairly long. But what evidence is there that it has changed? That's kind of a history of constitutional interpretation of which I'm not an expert. The Federal Society among lawyers is kind of set up to defend this view of originalism, and they're kind of going back to the early history of the court and the laws. So I think that's established. I don't have a better answer for you right now, in that someone would have to come up with examples where this kind of inventing new law and calling it interpretation had been done in the first 100 years of the court. I don't think it was. But there are books on the rise of activist judges. So someone asked me once, well, if we get a bunch of conservative justices on the Supreme Court, should they start doing the same thing, that is, making up new laws to outlaw abortion except for certain things or something like that? And my answer is no. The process should work according to how it was set up. The states and the Congress should pass the laws, and the court should have nothing to do with passing new laws. Yeah, Bob?
Wayne, I don't know for sure, but it seems to me that when a president proposed a person for the Supreme Court up until about the Bork hearings, it was pretty much a rubber stamp by the by the Senate, and it's only since then has it become so politicized. Is that historically
That's
true?
That's a fair summary, that it was thought that the president had the right to appoint and the Senate in most cases would just approve, and both parties would mostly approve. There were maybe a couple of exceptions, but generally that happened. Kathy?
Well, the point I'd like to emphasize is that the American people have allowed this to happen by not holding United States senators accountable for who they were confirming to the Supreme Court. So it still comes back to us at some level, and we see this, when we debate judicial selection in the state of Arizona, we debate the federal model a lot, and we need to, when we're voting for U.S. Senate, when we're voting for president, judicial philosophy should be one of the key issues that the American electorate is really evaluating, and that's since 1973 with Roe. There haven't been consequences at the ballot box for senators who have confirmed these justices who have changed our system of governance.
Yeah, very well put, Kathy. And now President Obama nominating Justice Sotomayor has nominated a justice who has this more liberal view of the justice's own idea of what should be the law, can become the basis for the decision. But senators voted to confirm her. And, of course, is the election of the president, I'm going to say this at the end of the next session, the election of the president is so important in this because the president nominates for appointment to the Supreme Court. Other hands here yet? We've got a few more minutes. Neville? Up here in front, do we have a mic for Neville? and Doug, just a second, you had the microphone. Okay, Doug first, Neville next.
It seems like we can sum it up very simply. I mean, elections have consequences.
Yeah.
And when you're in the midst of election, a character counts. And, I mean, a lot of people, I love history, so a lot of people said, well, Hitler really didn't mean what he wrote in Mein Kampf. Well, I think we better take that in consideration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Yeah, elections are very important. Okay, Neville?
I was just thinking in response to Scott's point, and actually you came back right back and made us aware of the fact that Justice Sotomayor made that very blatant statement that...
Justice needs empathy.
And that everybody knows that we actually make the laws. There was a video that was very evident.
Oh, I'd forgotten about that.
And that, to my shock, and I think to a lot of people, it just went by the wayside. And there was some defense and a lot of political processing to that.
But I think she meant what you thought she meant when you first heard it. Yep. Dave?
I'm tracking with you all the way on everything that we've learned thus far about what our responsibilities are and the things that we should do. But I'm feeling a little lost trying to understand this from God's perspective, because I also believe in the sovereignty of God. And so I'm trying to understand. So how, teach us how we should think of where we are, perhaps, from God, from a sovereign God's perspective, if that's a good question.
It's an excellent question. Romans 13, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. But I want to explain that by saying God, in his providential oversight or control of the destinies of nations, brings not only good but also evil rulers to nations for his purposes. Sometimes to bring blessing to a nation, but sometimes to bring judgment to a nation. And I think we could say that there's no nation on earth that deserves not to have God's judgment. I mean, there's sin on the part of all people and all nations. And so we certainly cannot complain if we have government that goes wrong and even harms and oppresses our nation. But we should cry to God for mercy, that he in his sovereignty would appoint good judges. Okay, Barry?
Wayne and I got to go to Peru. President Garcia single-handedly destroyed Peru in the 1980s. You heard me say a couple weeks ago, with 2,500% rates of inflation. And so he just melted the country down. It was called Shining Path. It was an offshoot of socialism. He's now the president of Peru. And to hear him talk, it's like he has done a born-again experience. You'd swear that he's been visiting with Milton Friedman. Now Garcia believes in kind of all of the things that conservatives believe. We've got to lower taxes, make it easier for people to get into business, and on and on and on. So you just can't believe how some human being can go from the far left of the spectrum and now in Peru, and we now were just there, so we'd love to see this begin to occur. And I don't know what else to call it but the sovereignty of God. What changes a person? Electoral reality is a cynical way to say, but are we going to give room for people to change? And my prayer, I don't spend an excessive amount of time praying for our president, but when I do pray for him, I really pray that God really changes his heart, his thinking, and where he's coming from. And it's not impossible. Garcia is a perfect example in Peru, and Pinochet is another example in Chile. Deng Xiaoping is another example in China. So God does. I'm not saying he's changed their hearts to become Christians. I did not say that. But he's changed their heart to say, take on a whole new view. And I think that would be most helpful.
Wonderful answer, Barry. Thank you. Okay, I am going to, for sake of time, unless there's just one other urgent. Steve, do you want to add anything here? I'm kind of looking around at my lawyers who give me advice and seeing. What? No, Larry. What's your name here? I talked to you yesterday. Yeah.
Roger.
Jerry, Larry, Roger. Sorry. And Joyce.
I'm a lawyer, and actually I used to work in Congress as a legislative assistant. And one thing that the people can do is every branch of the federal government, all three of them, they all have a independent obligation to satisfy themselves that legislation is constitutional. And some of the most effective letters that we ever got were from constituents saying, explain to me why a certain piece of legislation is constitutional. Now, congressmen don't know that. So their staffs send inquiries to the Library of Congress, which is the resource for congressmen to answer questions. And those people, they're constitutional scholars, provide position papers on almost everything. And that's one of them. So to elevate the debate from just political considerations of what's expedient, what's best, to constitutional considerations, and to demand that elected representatives justify to the people why they think the legislation is constitutional.
Okay, thanks.
For example, in health care, there are a number of constitutional defects that the legislature needs to be asked to explain.
Thanks, Roger. Good. Okay, I just want to announce one more. Thank you, all of you, except JT. Okay. There's one other thing that I just wanted to mention and mention for prayer. Last week, I got a call from Joe Infranco at the Alliance Defense Fund, and then a couple hours later from Fred Potter, the executive director of the Christian Legal Society. And there is a case called Christian Legal Society v. Martinez to be heard by the Supreme Court this term, probably in March. And the Christian Legal Society asked me to write the main body of a friend of the court, or amicus curiae, brief, arguing that evangelical Christian organizations have generally believed it necessary to require some standards of belief and conduct for leaders and voting members, and that sex outside of monogamous heterosexual marriage would disqualify someone. That's my rough and ready wording of it, and I'm maybe not exactly right on that, but you can give briefs to the court based on expert testimony, and maybe, I'm not a lawyer, but I do have some knowledge of evangelical theology. And so the idea is to write something and perhaps get a bunch of other presidents of the Evangelical Theological Society to sign on to it, saying Christian organizations have standards of conduct and belief and have to have them or they go out of existence. The idea is that Christian Legal Society was kicked off of the Hastings College of Law campus in California because it would not elect homosexuals, practicing homosexuals, to leadership positions or to voting membership positions. And they lost at the district court level, and they lost at the appeals court level, and now the Supreme Court, amazingly, has taken the case. So I've got 2 weeks to get that drafted. And then some lawyers will work over it and make it sound good and proper. So I appreciate your prayers about that. Fred Potter, who I just, it's one other thing about the way, about God's sovereignty, the way God works. God started getting ready for this 43 years ago when Fred Potter and his friend Mark Buchanan asked Jerry Brock and me if we'd like to room with them at Harvard for our sophomore year. So the head of the Christian Legal Society now is a former roommate of mine from undergraduate days at Harvard. So, yeah. And I just look back at that and say, that was an answer to prayer right then, roommate situation, sophomore year. And now here's a prayer situation again.